detail through leaked papers such as the FinCEN files and the Panama Papers, which not only named and shamed some of the rich and famous who had taken advantage of the system, but also embroiled several heads of states from around the world, showing that the problem stems from the bottom to the very top. However, there's a much more sinister way of avoiding taxes, and a way that on the surface, if used correctly and sensibly, will no doubt benefit millions of people around the world. In fact, many examples of philanthropy exist and have proven this. Take, for example, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has to date given money to those in poverty, those in need of education, and a host of vaccines, essentially eradicating polio through the foundation. However, there's a dark side and abuse of the philanthropy system, namely the fact that so many of the world's richest people use philanthropy to avoid paying taxes, as you don't have to pay taxes on the parts of your income that you donate. Tax avoidance schemes, according to CNBC, could cost the US alone as much as $5 trillion over the next decade, and this sum would come from only the top 1% of taxpayers. Yet it seems the problem is twofold. Not only are the companies and individuals involved finding ways to avoid the taxman, but the taxman himself is not performing, with only 3% of the richest people in the US being audited by the IRS. With so many people around the world avoiding paying tax on a monumental scale, should the governments and authorities not be doing more to stop this problem?
Now looking at, you know, for further revenue, governments are going to be thinking, well, where is the next place we're going to get money? And they're often not going to be able to just repeat what they did last time, whether that was increasing tax or taxes on the sort of majority of the population, or whether that was cutting back on the state. And so I think, you know, one natural area to kind of clamp down on is some of these reliefs and loopholes. But again, I think it's worth remembering, you know, often this idea of describing it as a loophole or relief is a way of a politician saying, you know, there is this problem here and it's somehow being used unreasonably, and that's fine. But then they should go, you know, politicians then have it within their gift to change those things.
All right, back in the studio with Mahan Abedin and Professor Sekar. Professor, let me start with you. It seems that the richest people and companies around the world have found ways to exploit taxes through loopholes and investment schemes, many of them preferring fines, which often amount to less than the profits being made. You pointed that out. Should there be then a tougher approach on measures finding this by the government and the authorities?
Well, these companies are only able to avoid taxes because the governments let them. Governments can enact tougher laws, but they don't, because the big corporations and richer people are able to fund political parties, and in a sense, they are not making donations. What they are making is investment, and the return on that investment is that they have become a law unto themselves. They avoid taxes. They engage in all kind of artificial profit-shifting tax schemes. They concoct transactions which have absolutely no economic substance, and many of these companies are hiding their profits in what are commonly called British Crown dependencies and overseas territories, places like Jersey, Guernsey, Gibraltar, Isle of Man, and many others. So the British government can deal with these companies, these small islands, so can other countries too. But actually the political will is not there, because our political system is actually inept. It works against the interests of ordinary people. So we have a position in the UK at the moment where some of the poorest people are paying 40%, 42% of their total income in direct and indirect taxes, compared to the rich people who are paying about 32-34% of their total income in taxes. That is immoral, and that must be addressed.
Okay, Mahan, looking at the opposite end of the spectrum here, whilst the rich are getting richer, the poor actually falling deeper into poverty. Maybe that's one of the reasons, or the taxes, the way that it's being exercised on them. Do you think that the wealth gap is actually widening and deepening because the rich are allowed to exploit these loopholes like taxes? And how can the gap be bridged then in the near future?
Again, in a nutshell, yes. And look, the gap cannot be bridged because, as your guest correctly pointed out, the political will isn't there. Now, we know that the political systems in Western Europe, particularly in the UK, and also in North America, they are very corrupt.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kavita Hawaii. Time now to take a deeper look into this week's topic in our in-depth section. The collective wealth of all U.S.-based billionaires increased by just over $1.1 trillion since mid-March of 2020. Now, that is a near 40% increase in wealth during a period of national emergency. The huge sum of money to pay for the relief of working families in the U.S. contained in the $1.9 trillion coronavirus package proposed by U.S. President Joe Biden. With a combined fortune of U.S.'s 660 billionaires in January of 2021 was around $4.1 trillion. That's up some 38.6% year-on-year. However, it is the fact that some 46 new billionaires were formed in the U.S. during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic that really raises the eyebrows as to, well, how that could have come from 614 people prior to the outbreak. Looking at the opposite end of the scale, ordinary Americans have not fared as well as the billionaires. According to the Department of Labor, over 73 million people lost their jobs during the pandemic, with 16 million people collecting unemployment checks. Unlike the likes of Amazon and Tesla, some 100,000 businesses also permanently closed during the pandemic. Now, things did not end there. According to the Economic Policy Institute, some 12 million workers also lost their employer-sponsored health insurance, whilst the Center of Budget and Policy Priorities stated that 29 million American adults reported their households did not have enough food to eat, with 12 million children going hungry as incomes dried up and mouths could no longer be fed. Let's take a look at our final report, which studies why, during the toughest of times, governments are still forking out billions to private companies, once again putting cash into the pockets of the rich.
There's no doubting the notion that the state and private corporations live and work hand in hand. In fact, it's the very backbone of capitalism that allows private enterprise. On many occasions, the state needs to use private companies in order to fulfill its needs, be it through transport, education, infrastructure, or more. The relationship goes hand in glove in order for a state to operate and provide the facilities that citizens are entitled to enjoy. However, there are occasions when the relationship between states and private sectors could be questioned, particularly when it comes to the state forking out multi-million dollar contracts to companies during a time when spending and priorities should be stricter than ever.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the context of the pandemic, the issue has really been sort of do what works best when it's possible. So, I mean, in the UK, for example, you know, the NHS has been heavily involved in the rolling out of the vaccine, and that's been really important. You know, using the state and the capacity that we already have in the UK to do that has been really, really useful. But at the same time, transporting these sort of ultra-cold vaccines around the place, you know, to keep them at minus 80 or whatever it is, you know, the government contracted Boots and Superdrug to be able to use their, you know, freezer lorries to take stuff around. And that's a sensible use of public money spent moving into private hands, but where that's where the capacity is to go ahead and move stuff around.
One such example is a recent contract won by billionaire Elon Musk and his SpaceX company. The U.S. Space Development Agency, run by the U.S. military and hence a government entity, has recently tendered a contract of $150 million for SpaceX to launch 28 satellites on behalf of the Pentagon. As recently as this month, NASA has also selected SpaceX to launch an astrophysics mission, once again seeing Musk's company earn a tidy $98.8 million for the honor, raising the question as to just whether such spending in times of such crisis can be warranted, as well as asking whether Musk is being favoured in the deals taking place. In total, Musk's various companies, ranging from Tesla, SpaceX and SolarCity Corp, have benefited from just under $5 billion of government support, a figure that seems to highlight a common factor between governments and multi-billion dollar enterprises.
Joining me back in the studio for the final time in this episode is current affairs and impact analyst Mohan Abedin, and we also have Baron Prem Sika, Emeritus Professor of Accounting from Essex University. Gentlemen, welcome back. Okay, Professor, my last question. Why some companies are earning multi-million dollar contracts with the governments, We can mention as an example Elon Musk, SpaceX being one example, and hence raising the question as to whether governments around the world should consider other priorities before funding private individuals and companies, particularly during the ongoing pandemic.
I think you just put your finger on one of the biggest fictions in the Western world, this claim that we have so-called free markets. These free markets are funded by the state, not only through various contracts for private companies, but also through subsidies and the provision of social infrastructure, roads, railways, healthcare for employees, education for everybody, and at the end, the corporations benefit. So I think the balance at the moment that we have in our societies about private and public spheres is incorrect, and it is wrong, and it is enabling some to make mega profits. And then you find the companies which are benefiting, and you mentioned Apple, Microsoft, many others, they then decide to dodge taxes. In other words, they refuse to put something back into the pot, the very pot which has enabled them to flourish and make even more profits. But I think ordinary people are more and more sensitized now to tax avoidance, and they are demanding change. And the governments should listen, but at the moment they are not listening. But that call for social justice will get louder and louder, because in the post-COVID world, we need to rebuild our society on principles of social justice. We can't go back to the world which existed before, where millions of people are increasingly barely surviving, while the number of billionaires who are exploiting society and those people is increasing.
All right. Many thanks to you, Professor Prem Sikka. It's been a pleasure having you on this program.
Well, thank you for speaking to me, and it's been a great pleasure to be on your program.
Very well. Well, if you'd like to know more about corporate tax avoidance, the banking empire, and secret offshore wealth funds, be sure to check out The Spider's Web, Britain's Second Empire documentary on YouTube, which explores the issue and in which Professor Prem Sikka features in. Okay, Mahan, my final question now to you. As we know, many of the richest people in the world have direct links to the government. We've been saying that, either through being part donors or through being involved in government through some kind of medium. Is there enough transparency when it comes to allocating government contracts, for example, or are they likely chosen even before they are offered to the tender?
No, there isn't. But I'd just like to go back to something your guest said, because he's not the only one to echo this thought that we need to have this great reset after the pandemic is over, start afresh. This is an opportunity for change. In principle, that sounds nice, but it's just not going to happen. You know, people are going to go back to the old ways. There isn't sufficient will, nowhere near the will that's required to reset the system. And I think the Western world, in terms of how its economy is configured and how the associated politics is run, is too deeply entrenched for any great reformation. It's just not going to happen.
Very well. Thank you very much for that, Mahan Abedin, Current Affairs and Impact Analyst. We also like to thank Professor Varun Prem Sikka. There's no doubt that money makes money. This has proven to be true more than ever as the ultra-rich become even richer during times of hardship. Whilst at the opposite end of the economic ladder, poverty is on the rise across the poorest deciles of society. Yet there also seems to be an unfair advantage. The recent purchase of $1.5 billion of Bitcoin by Elon Musk saw the value of the cryptocurrency surge to a record high of over $44,000 each, simply because of Musk's endorsement of the currency. Could this extreme power hence be adding to the wealth of those able to perform such acts? It seems that very little is being done to stop wealthy individuals getting richer, with governments also in on the act of lining the pockets of Musk, Bezos, and more, hence seeing many enjoy double jackpot profits for their companies and for themselves. That's all the time we have for week's show. On behalf of myself, Kovat Tahway, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
An Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Open, it's about to dampen all over the house. I have to close the window. Oh, look at there. What a beautiful rainbow. Seven beautiful colors next to each other. Oh, wow. What an exciting coincidence. You know why? Because today I'm going to take you to an extraordinary place which might look like a rainbow, to the seven-colored spring of Mojen. The seven-colored spring of Mojen is one of the unique springs of Iran. This spring is located 25 kilometers north of Shahrud in Semnan province. The seven-colored spring of Mojen is a type of sulfur spring. The colorfulness of this spring is because of the presence of different types of minerals around this spring. The sulfurous water of this spring is used for treating skin and skeletal diseases. The diversity of flora and fauna of this region is also of great importance. The city of Shahrud is a paradise for nature lovers. This city is covered with all manifestations of beauty, including desert, mountains, waterfall, river, and green forest, which are seen everywhere. I am now on the foothill of Shahwar Mountain. In the cavities of the valleys of this mountain flows the Mojen Spring. To reach this colorful spring, I have to walk a little. What a gorgeous scenery! On my sides, there are beautiful trees and bushes. What a bizarre odor! This is sulfur. It shows that I'm getting close to the Mojen Spring. Oh my God, what an astonishing combination of beauty. Here, there are just color and color and color. And what beautiful colors. This part of the spring is red in color. Oh, the water of the spring is hot. The other side of the spring is turquoise in color. And a little farther, it's greenish. It's more like a dream. I can't believe such a pretty and colorful spring exists on Earth. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
US President Joe Biden's administration has announced three symbolic gestures toward Iran in an apparent break with former President Donald Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. Ned Price, a spokesman for the State Department, said Thursday the Biden administration was willing to meet with Iranian officials and other world powers involved in negotiating the nuclear deal. Price said Washington would accept an invitation from the European Union's top diplomat to attend a meeting aimed to discuss a diplomatic way forward on Iran's nuclear program.
But the U.S. is trying to play a little game here by saying, I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to meet Iranians and I want to talk about the JCPOA, and maybe the U.S. will lift some sanctions. It's just the message the U.S. is just not getting it right. The U.S. needs to understand when Iran stopped giving false hope that there is no return to the JCPOA unless the Americans lift all sanctions, apply the lifting of the sanctions, allow Iran to sell its oil and to make deal with other companies as stated in the JCPOA, and then Iran will stop withdrawing from the nuclear deal.
Washington says it has lifted travel restrictions on Iranian diplomats accredited to the United Nations, headquartered in New York, limitations that were imposed by Trump in 2019. Also, in a letter to the UN Security Council on behalf of Biden, acting U.S. Ambassador Richard Nils said the United States has withdrawn three letters from the Trump administration that claimed the U.S. had reimposed UN sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Nils said that sanctions measures terminated in Resolution 2231 endorsing the nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, with six world powers, remain terminated. This is why the overwhelming majority of the members in the 15-nation council had described Trump's bid to restore UN embargoes on Iran as illegal, arguing the U.S. was no longer a member of the JCPOA. In a tweet, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif responded to the U.S. acknowledgement that the snapback mechanism of the JCPOA has not been triggered. He reiterated Iran's position that Washington must lift all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled under the Trump administration before Tehran reverses its scaleback of the commitments under the nuclear accord. Zarif had earlier urged France, Britain, and Germany, three European signatories to the nuclear agreement, to abandon their calls on Iran to act first to salvage the JCPOA and instead demand an end to the U.S. quote, economic terrorism on Tehran. In a reaction to the U.S. announcement that it would accept the EU's invitation to a meeting of Iran and the P5+1, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said P5+1 no longer exists due to Washington's withdrawal from the deal. He repeated Iranian officials' stance that the U.S. must first put its words into action before Tehran follows suit. Even after the U.S. exit from the JCPOA and the reimposition of sanctions, Iran remained fully committed to the accord for a year before gradually reducing its commitments in five steps, citing the failure of the European signatories to the deal to keep their end of the bargain.
Iran made it very clear the government is forced to abide by the decision of the parliament, and the parliament decided to implement several steps, one after the other. The first one is the 21st of February, and on the 21st of February, Iran will withdraw from the voluntary protocol and will reduce the sudden inspection of the atomic energy inspector. Therefore, the Americans need to understand that there are other steps that will follow if the sanctions are not lifted.
The country has times and again noted that all the retaliatory steps are reversible once all signatories honor their obligations.
Myanmar has been the scene of mass demonstrations against junta leaders ever since the February 1 coup. Anti-coup protesters have defied a crackdown by the military, taking to the streets in several cities across the country almost daily. Demonstrators are demanding the release of the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who was detained along with a number of parliament members. They're also demanding the restoration of civilian rule. Myanmar's junta has ratcheted up security measures to quell anti-coup demonstrations, and the internet in Yangon has been down for several days. Junta leaders deny they staged a coup and justified their power seizure by alleging widespread voter fraud in November elections that Suu Kyi's party won. They also pledge to hold new elections soon. This, however, has failed to calm down the situation.
I guess a lot of times with the Burma army and the Burmese dictators, they are always above the law. So why he doesn't calm the situation is because he doesn't want to calm the situation, because he wants things to be under his control, and he wanted to hold on to the power the way he wants to run the country. And that is why, although you will see a lot of chaotic going on, and you would think that if he is sincere about, if he's talking about the election issues and election is fraud, if that is the case, then why violence?
The army generals have filed multiple charges against the deposed leader, including ignoring an import and export law over walkie-talkies that were found in her home during the search. The Nobel laureate's lawyer says she has also been hit with a second charge, which is violating the country's disaster management law. Observers believe the accusations against Suu Kyi are an indication that the military is seeking a permanent grip on power.
Nobody knows how long the military is going to hold on to the power, but it is very worrisome that they probably may not want to let go the power, because for so many reasons, especially those who are in power, like high-ranking position like Mae Aung-le, he has so much political ambition in order to become the president, and even more so in order to control and have control over his own economic ambitions.
The military seizure of power has drawn global reactions. The United Nations has warned the army of several consequences of any harsh response to protesters. The UN Special Rapporteur said Myanmar's generals will be held accountable for any suppression of the civil disobedience campaign there. The coup also drew reactions from other international players. China said the situation in Myanmar is not what Beijing wants to see. It also rejected social media rumors that China was involved in the coup as complete nonsense. However, China, along with Russia, says the coup is Myanmar's internal affair. The United States, however, has taken a different stance. Last Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden announced new sanctions on those responsible for the coup and any entities linked to junta leaders. Biden said Washington will be ready to impose additional measures. There is also the risk of a new confrontation between U.S. and China, maybe over Myanmar.
I mean, look, yes, the U.S. is talking about threatening to impose sanctions, targeted sanctions especially. And what did they do in the past week? They did impose some targeted sanctions, but it's just on what, on the gems companies. But the most important thing to follow, to go behind, is the oil and gas company that is owned by the military. That is where they make whole bunch of money in order to buy their submarines, their warplanes, all kinds of sophisticated weapons, which we call Mag and Mel, the oil company. They didn't do anything about it. That is something we wanted to see the U.S. will sanction.
The two nuclear-armed countries are already facing off on a range of other issues, including the U.S. interference in China's periphery, such as the South China Sea and the Korean Peninsula, as well as the trade and cyber wars between them. Myanmar is just another geopolitical war threat for China and the U.S., but observers believe Beijing has an edge over Washington in this struggle.
Saudi Arabia could not have it any better. As soon as the former U.S. President Donald Trump came into office, it was evident that he intended to solidify the relationship with Saudi Arabia even more than before. And the businessman that Trump was, that translated into weapon sales to Saudi Arabia.
$533 million.
The Saudis were more than happy to comply. Through their weapons purchases, they also bought the loyalty of the U.S. president when it came to their wrongdoings, like their human rights violations, and of course, the Saudi war in Yemen, and the grave violations that were taking place there. The U.S. president even shielded the Crown Prince for the brutal murder assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, which the world condemned as a heinous crime. That included the current U.S. President Joe Biden, an act which may have been the straw that broke the camel's back when it came to Saudi Arabia and the Crown Prince. This may explain why Joe Biden has announced that King Salman is whom he would communicate with in Saudi Arabia, and not Bin Salman, even though Bin Salman is in fact the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia.
And on Saudi Arabia, I would say, you know, we've made clear from the beginning that we're going to recalibrate our relationship with Saudi Arabia, and that, you know, President Biden, on one of the questions there was also, just to go back to the context of it, whether he would be speaking with MBS. And part of that is going back to engagement counterpart to counterpart. The president's counterpart is King Salman. And I expect that an appropriate time, he would have a conversation with him. I don't have a prediction of the timeline on that.
I think that the significance of this snub of Biden's statement is the suggestion that by the White House or Biden will not consider Saudi Arabia as synonymous with Mohammed bin Salman, but rather seek to establish a relationship with Saudi Arabia that does not uniquely or exclusively depend on Mohammed bin Salman. And of course, that can carry many meanings. At the moment, it just seems to be a statement of significance in expressing the intentions of the Biden administration to rein in Mohammed bin Salman.
The Saudi Crown Prince, however, was forewarned of Biden's stance towards him. Biden used pretty tough language specifically against Mohammed bin Salman during his campaign trail, calling him a pariah. Tough language that the Saudis were not used to hearing. Even though the U.S. President Joe Biden claims that human rights is a barometer when it comes to Saudi Arabia, then why would it sell weapons to other countries, like in the case of Egypt, in which President Sisi is known for rights abuses in that country? The U.S. President has plans for West Asia, or the Middle East region, that goes beyond Saudi Arabia and Israel. The region's security is still very much a concern for the U.S., but regional dynamics and equations may be changing. First off, ending the U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
If the U.S. wants to establish regional security, it will need the Islamic Republic of Iran. The U.S. realizes the military power that Iran possesses, and without this power, the region will be in flux due to tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia and Israel, and with the resistance groups in the region. In order for this to be solved, the U.S. realizes that it has no choice other than to rejoin the JCPOA. This can decrease tensions significantly, even though both Saudi Arabia and Israel are not enthusiastic about this, nor do they support it. Iran is also looking for regional stability, but without U.S. presence in the region. This comes in the form of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani's vision for peace called the Hormuz Peace Initiative, or the Hormuz Peace Plan, in order to establish security in the region, including the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, and the Sea of Oman. This will involve regional countries.
The message coming from Biden is that while we are not lifting sanctions, we are offering concessions in other places, in other issues. And I think for Iran in particular, it's a matter of to what extent can we trust the U.S. to lift the sanctions if we do eventually come to a deal.
But why would the U.S. be after this approach to West Asia? The Pentagon, at Biden's direction, has undertaken a review of changes that need to be made to U.S. military deployments worldwide, with an eye towards countering the growing threat from China. West Asia is no longer a number one priority for the U.S. It remains to be seen, however, if the U.S. lifts Iran's sanctions in order for this plan to bear fruit and for Iran to return to the JCPOA. The U.S. President Joe Biden's approach towards Saudi Arabia changing, however, is just a mirage, since Saudi Arabia has continued bombing Yemen and throughout all the previous U.S. administrations, and despite U.S. promises made, U.S. support has not changed, neither for Saudi Arabia nor for Israel.
The Israeli military has once again carried out a number of missile attacks from the occupied Syrian Golan Heights, targeting several army positions near the capital, Damascus. The Syrian media have confirmed the attacks, saying Israeli jets flew over the Golan Heights to hit targets on the edge of Damascus. They also said the country's air defense intercepted and shut down most of the missiles fired toward Damascus. But this is not the first time the regime attacks Syria. Israel has done hundreds of air and missile strikes on government troops and their allies there. Some believe the attacks are aimed at undermining the country's military capabilities.
This has been the focus for the last few years. Israel's focus especially has been towards Syria's air defense systems. I don't think they have been successful, however, because clearly Syrian air defense systems are working well and better than they did at the start of the war. Most of Israel's missiles have been shot down.
The Israeli attacks against Syria have been going on ever since the country was gripped by foreign-backed militancy in March 2011. The Syrian government forces have already clawed back much of the territory it lost to terrorist groups in the first couple of years of the Syrian conflict. Syrian troops are now engaged in a few mopping-up operations to clear the country from the remnants of Takfiri terror groups. The Syrian government says the Israeli regime and its Western and regional allies are aiding Takfiris that reduced large swathes of Syria to rubble.
Well, the U.S. is continuing their four-decade tradition of supporting terrorism in the region. They continue to fund the White Helmets, which, as we know, is al-Qaeda with white hats on. In Idlib province, they continue to try to extend the conflict in the northwest of Syria, where Al Qaeda has taken over the entirety of Idlib province, and they admit that Al Qaeda is the biggest force in that region, and they want to maintain or continue that war for as long as possible by supporting Al Qaeda.
Monday's attack on Syria comes as senior Israeli military officials have previously said that escalating attacks inside the Arab country are aimed at ending Iran's military presence there. This is while Iran says its military presence in Syria is upon a request from the Damascus government, adding that Tehran has not received any message demanding it leave Syria.
Of course, the Syrian government invited Iran to support Syria against the terrorist and Zionist attack. Syria and Iran have been allies for decades. And of course, this is also in Iran's interest because those terrorists will eventually try to attack within Iran. And of course, the whole point of the war is why the US caused the war in the first place is for Israel's sake. And that is to try to create a new government in Syria that would not be allied to Iran. They're trying to break up the Syrian-Iranian alliance.
Damascus has sent many letters of protest to the UN to demand a world body end the Israeli aggression. So far, to no avail.
Well, Israel continuously is breaking international law by breaching Syrian sovereignty. And we also know that they have done this for decades in Palestine, and the United Nations hasn't been able to do anything about it. They are now trying to take Israel to the International Criminal Court, and this is something that's been resisted by the US and even Germany. So the problem with the United Nations is that at the end of the day, who controls what happens? It's the country that has the power, that has nuclear weapons, and therefore the UN is a bit of a joke, because even if they were to condemn Israel for its crimes, which even that they're not able to do, they wouldn't be able to physically do anything to bring Israel to justice.
Many construe the West's silence towards continued Israeli attacks on Syria as tactical support for the aggression. They also attribute the escalation in the attacks to Israel's anger over the victory of Syria and the axis of resistance in the face of the years-long militancy against the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The militancy is widely seen as a foreign-backed plot to bring about regime change in Syria and partition it into weak states in favor of Israel's geostrategic interests. The militancy failed. Now Syria is nearly in full control of its territory and is on track towards stability. Thank you.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
The result of the U.S.'s presence in our country was economic and scientific poverty, corruption, and cultural decadence. They created such a condition in our country. Now, some people think that if we interact, make up, and become good friends with the U.S., the country will become something of a paradise. No, that will not be the case, and you only need to look at the pre-revolutionary era to see what things were like back then. Look at those countries which exchange loving words with the U.S. to see in what condition they are. You can clearly see their economic and scientific condition. There are some countries in our own region, but I do not want to mention their names. You yourselves know which countries I'm speaking about. Of course, even after the victory of our great revolution, the U.S. did not stop its plots. The U.S. is after achieving the same hellish domination over our country. Not only our country, but also the whole region.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want of me. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Some people ask, What is the difference between the US and such and such a European country? The difference lies in this fact. Because the US used to ensure its interest for many years in Iran, because it had built itself a nice home here, and because it considers itself to be the superior power, it wants to restore the previous conditions. This is what makes the Iranian nation vigilant and careful. Of course, some treacherous countries in the region are helping it as well. I wish to add that in the current circumstances, the US finds its interest in creating instability in the region until it manages to achieve complete domination over the region. Until then, it finds its interest in creating instability in the region. This is being acknowledged explicitly by themselves. A well-known expert in a famous American organization, the American Enterprise Institute, if I mention his name, those who are interested in political work will organize him easily, said this openly. He said that they are not after creating stability in Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. He does not just mention Iran. Rather, he mentions Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, saying that they are not interested in stability in those countries.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held a press conference aimed at expressing their refusal of the recent normalization of ties with Israeli regime. The conference comes as a code of ethics for Palestinian journalists and media institutes to stress the rejection for normalizing ties with Israel.
We condemn the recent normalization of ties with Israel. We held this conference as a code of ethics for journalists and media institutes to reveal the Israeli violations and normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. The normalization of ties remains a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
A number of Palestinian leaders, activists, and journalists attended the conference and condemned establishing Israeli relations, stressing that no deal can bring peace to Israel in the West Asia. Palestinian journalists and activists added that media has a significant role in conveying the true image of the inhumane Israeli regime and refused any normalization of ties with Israel in terms of media.
Normalizing ties with Israel is a way to justify the inhumane nature of Israel. The recent normalization of ties with Israel is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause, and we won't accept any recognition of Israel at the expense of Palestinians.
Palestinians call on Arab and Muslim nations to end these normalization of ties with Israel that aims to demolish the historical Palestinian cause.
Palestinian activists are all united to say that normalization of ties with Israel is a betrayal of all Palestinians. Media should stand against these attempts to demolish the Palestinian cause. All Arabs and Muslims should stop recognizing Israel as a state.
So far, a number of Arab states have normalized their ties with Israel, including the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. The move has sparked harsh criticism among the Muslim nations.
Palestinians here stress they strongly refuse to recognize Israel and reject the normalization of ties with the Tel Aviv regime by certain countries. They say the resistance is ongoing and no deal can bring peace to Israel at the expense of Palestinians. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
The average student in the United States today leaves college with $37,000 of debt from student loans. University tuition has risen 1,200% since the late 1970s. Those younger than 24, called Generation Z, face the same prospect of expensive higher education combined with national economic stagnation since 2008. While on the campaign trail, Democrats raised major hopes with talk of an executive order canceling up to $50,000 in student debt. But President Joe Biden just declared, quote, "I will not make that happen," and he will only consider $10,000 in debt relief.
Student debt is parasitic. It's very right-wing. Joe Biden isn't centrist. He's right-wing. He's always been right-wing. If this person said that he had the capability to do it, which he does, and he said he does, and he's not going to do it because it sets the wrong precedent, then you're going to have a bunch of angry people.
Such huge amounts of debt has forced the millennial class to often delay mature steps, like buying a house, investing, pursuing a graduate degree, marriage, and children. That all depresses the economy, creates more social instability and disharmony, and all the while, economic inequality skyrockets in favor of the moneylenders.
I have $28K in student debt. Under capitalism, like, college can be a very predatory thing. You're betting the rest of your life to, like, being able to make these payments. And this is going to create more distrust for the Democrats. This is going to embolden more people that might be Republican that also have a lot of student debt to not trust this person.
The student debt crisis is seemingly a uniquely American issue, but 45 million Americans owe almost $2 trillion in student debt. The immense scope of the problem seems to ensure that the nation's young adults will keep this issue in the limelight for years, or maybe even decades, until either debt relief is granted or wages massively rise. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
The scramble for vaccines has exposed global inequality yet again. Rich economies, including the US, EU, and the UK, have collectively secured more than double the amount they need, 3 billion doses, and administered 75% of the vaccines actually in existence. But in dozens of countries, no one has been vaccinated.
We are more than a little bit concerned that there is or is to be hoarding and price gouging, as well as undue preference in some quarters. This being so, we at CARICOM have recently called upon WHO to immediately convene an international convention of the world's people's representatives to commiserate, explain, assist, and commit to a fair sharing of the available vaccine resources for the benefit of all humankind and not just the privileged, well-heeled few.
Accused of hoarding, world leaders at the G7 summit Friday tried to stave off criticism by making more pledges. The UK has boasted about leading the world out of the pandemic, but Boris Johnson says the UK comes first, and spare doses will only be given away once all British adults have got the jab. The projection for that is July. US President Joe Biden also used the G7 summit, his first international meeting, to redeem Washington's reputation as the largest contributor to organizations like the World Health Organization. Geopolitics is at play here. Russia and China have emerged as major vaccine suppliers, but the EU has been accused of failing to execute a fair and even rollout, forcing nations to look elsewhere for supplies. China and Russia have already shipped tens of thousands of doses of their COVID-19 vaccine to developing and underdeveloped countries as well. Meanwhile, the US has stopped short of donating from its own massive supply. Amnesty International says rich countries do themselves no favors by hoarding. In the end, If not enough people are immunized, the virus will have free range to mutate and outsmart the vaccines. Bianca Rahim.